Hello again, I'm Armin Alde. Last year, before his inauguration, President Trump was briefed about Russia's attack on America's electoral process. The evidence included texts, emails, and a human source so close to Vladimir Putin that intelligence officials didn't want to write down the name. That's according to David Sanger of the New York Times. Ever since, Mr. Trump has tried to dispute those findings, as he did standing next to Putin after their meeting in Helsinki. Sources in the Trump White House say that's because the president fears the story will cast doubt on his election victory in 2016. Now he's contradicting his own Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, who says Russian cyber threats are still blinking red in the run-up for this year's elections. Now that's raising questions about the threat of cyber warfare and how it works, and David Sanger has made that a specialty. The atomic bomb has been called the ultimate weapon. Sanger's latest book is titled The Perfect Weapon. The subtitle is War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He reports that nations around the world, including the United States, have been slow to recognize another weaponized technology. And there's a special challenge. Everybody's connected to the Internet. David Sanger, welcome as always.
Thanks, Warren. Great to be back with you.
What makes for a perfect weapon? What do you mean by that?
Well, nuclear and cyber are frequently referred to in the same sentence, as if the themes, the methods, the technologies, and the politics that we used to try to prevent nuclear war from breaking out would also help us in preventing cyber conflict from breaking out. In fact, they're entirely different. Nuclear weapons are only possessed by 9 states. Cyber weapons are now possessed by 30 or 40, although that number has risen dramatically in the past few years. Nuclear weapons basically run on an on-off switch. You either detonate one or you don't. And it's pretty clear where it came from. You can go into a big cave in Colorado Springs where there are those screens on the wall, and you can see an incoming missile through the North American air defense operations. You can't do that with cyber. You probably won't know for a long time, if ever, where a cyber attack came from. And that makes it very hard to deter. And nuclear weapons are held almost entirely by states. Cyber weapons are held by states, and that's what most of the book is about. But they're also held by criminal groups, by terrorists, sometimes by teenagers. So it's very hard, frequently, to know whether or not an attack was a state-sponsored event that requires a military response, or was just a criminal event that you would answer with, say, an indictment. So all of these make cyber much harder to defend against, and they also make it the perfect weapon for the attacker, because so much about cyber is cloaked from view.
In your previous book, Confront and Conceal, you reported that the U.S. and Israel conducted a cyber offensive against Iran's nuclear program. How did you get into this stuff?
Well, I actually got into it, Warren, not from Confront and Conceal, but from a previous book called The Inheritance, which dealt with what Barack Obama was inheriting from George W. Bush. It came out just weeks before President Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009. And one of the things that reported was that in his effort to try to keep Israel from bombing Iran and Iran's nuclear facilities, President Bush had authorized both the military and the intelligence community to come up with a very sophisticated cyber weapon that could be used in a stealthy fashion against the Iranian nuclear program. And what made this different was that while there had been some limited cyber attacks before, there had never been something of quite this sophistication, the sophistication of what ultimately became codenamed Operation Olympic Games. And the operation was intended to do what previously you could only do by bombing a country or sending in saboteurs, that is, to go in and reprogram the centrifuges that spin away at supersonic speeds and make enriched uranium, the basis of a nuclear weapon. And instead, it sped those up or slowed them down enough to destabilize them and make the centrifuges blow up. Well, at the time that President Obama reauthorized this program, shortly after the book came out, and they were pretty angry, as you can imagine, that word of this had made its way out, President Obama was quite concerned that once the U.S. began using cyber weapons in a sophisticated way, other countries would feel emboldened to do the same. And that's now exactly what's happened. When I wrote Confront and Conceal just 6 years ago, which described at length the debates inside the Situation Room about the use of cyber weapons, it was very hard to find a state other than Israel and the United States that had used cyber in such a sophisticated way. Today, as I was putting together over the past few years the perfect weapon, you stopped counting state-sponsored cyber attacks after we passed 200 or 250, and those are only the ones we know about.
We know that the U.S. has used this kind of a weapon. What about countries against the U.S.? To what extent have they used it?
There are a lot of countries that have. I focus on four in particular in the book because they're the four you've read about the most in newspaper accounts of cyber attacks. There's North Korea, which did the famous attack on Sony, stole $81 million from the Central Bank of Bangladesh going through the New York Fed, and that was behind the WannaCry attack against the British healthcare system, or affected the British healthcare system. And of course, that one was based on a weapon that was actually stolen from the American arsenal, making it all the more complex. Iran's used cyber weapons against the Saudis. It's used them against American banks. You've seen China use cyber weapons not only to steal intellectual property, but to go in a very stealthy way and take out, say, all of the security records on 22 million Americans. And those were stored in the an office in the United States or an agency in the United States called the Office of Personnel Management. Sounds like a really boring bureaucracy, but it turned out that it held some of the most sensitive security information the U.S. possesses. And, of course, they're the Russians, who not only did the attack or on the Democratic National Committee, but have used cyber for such a range of other attacks. And this book goes in great detail about how the United States failed to confront the Russians during attacks on the White House, the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, leaving open the question to President Putin, if the U.S. wasn't prepared to defend the White House and the State Department, why would it ever bother worrying about, say, the Democratic National Committee?
We're getting some very slight hits as you speak, and I should tell our listeners that we're talking to David Sanger now, who is in Spain. We are, in fact, in Santa Monica, California. I don't think it interrupts the conversation. It's very clear what exactly he is saying, but if that's disturbing to you, that's the reason that you're hearing it. It's really nothing to worry about. So, David, were these attacks that you described perfect attacks in the sense that you defined earlier what a perfect weapon is?
Some were and some weren't. When the Chinese went in to get the data from the Office of Personnel Management, they were in collecting material for a year before the United States caught on to what was happening. And in fact, the Office of Personnel Management not encrypted any of these files with the most sensitive information that people fill out when they're trying to get security clearances, not just their names and social security numbers and birth dates, but details of their medical details of their past relationships, details about their kids, their finances, the material that you could use not only to blackmail people, but also to understand exactly who they knew and what projects they worked on. The U.S. was clueless to the fact that all of this information was on its way out to Beijing, or that the Chinese were encrypting it on its way there. Similarly, while the U.S. saw the attacks on the State Department and on the White House, they thought at the time it was just sort of standard espionage. And nobody really understood that what the Russians were doing was getting ready to do the kind of attacks in the United States that they've done for a long time in Ukraine. And in fact, for the book, I went to Ukraine, and the chapter on the book about how Ukraine became the testing ground for this material is called Putin's Petri Dish, because that's exactly what the country has been. So what's happened here is that countries have had an imagination about how to use cyber that has wildly outpaced our own defenses.
Tell us a little bit more, that's an extraordinary chapter, about what happened in Ukraine. It had both enormously significant and very obvious effects and other effects that weren't so obvious.
That's right. I mean, everybody's in eastern Ukraine. The Russians have sent in irregular forces, not in uniform. I used to call them the little green men, who were doing everything they could to disrupt activity there, low-level assassinations, military action, basically to make it a breakaway area from central Ukraine, try to destabilize the Ukrainian government. That's the seen war. The unseen war is the cyber war that's going on each and every day. And that's happening not just in the east, but right in Kiev, the capital. There have been two big power outages in Ukraine, both of which were triggered by Russians who figured out how to get inside the utility system and take it over so that the Ukrainian utility operators were sitting at their desks, their workstations, and seeing what was happening on their screens, that power stations were being shut off. But as they moved their mouse or typed on their keyboards, everything was disconnected. They were completely powerless. That happened twice. Similarly, the Russians messed around with the Ukrainian election and nearly got the TV stations to report false results. In fact, the TV stations back in Russia did report false numbers. The Ukrainians caught the change just at the last minute. And we've seen the Russians post things on Facebook, try all kinds of disinformation, anything they could to create discord inside Ukraine. Well, these were all practice runs for exactly what happened here in 2016.
How is it done? What sort of technology is involved? You talk about implants and you talk about false messages and the kind of things that you just described. Is it really all that sophisticated and difficult?
Some of it was sophisticated and difficult, and some of it was very, very easy. Most of what the Russians did was pretty easy. Turned out that the Russian utility companies had very weak defenses because they didn't have very much money to spend on cyber defense. And that's worth thinking about because, well, the biggest American utilities have pretty good cyber defenses. There are a lot of smaller companies that do not and have not been able to invest in it. The Russians were quite good at getting into election systems. Well, as we know in the United States, every state runs their elections differently. Some use internet-connected registration systems where you can dial in at home and begin to change information about your voter profile or sign up to vote or announce that you've moved to another state. Supposing the Russians had been more successful in getting into those systems, and they were pretty successful in Illinois and Arizona and some other places, and changed it so that, Warren, when you went to the polls in 2016, they said, gee, Warren, this is really interesting because you've lived in California for so many years, but it shows here that you moved to Arizona 4 weeks ago. Well, you can imagine the chaos that could be created on a mass scale. And that's only the beginning in the world of data manipulation. You know, as we put more medical records online, you could imagine a situation in which an adversary could change the blood types of soldiers registered in the military. You could imagine what kind of chaos could be created if they can get inside the data streams that guide autonomous cars. And suddenly the car isn't going to the supermarket as you intended, but headed to a cliff. So there are all kinds of new vulnerabilities. And one of the things I think that sort of so surprised me is that while we're getting better at our cyber defenses, we're connecting so many new devices to the internet that new targets are opening up faster than we can think up new defenses.
You mentioned the situation with the Office of Personnel Management, and one of the things that was taken out of there was medical information. You said, does that mean that whoever did that does have the capacity now to change medical records in the way you described?
It's an interesting question because they sucked the records out, but we don't have any evidence that the Chinese actually tried to change that data. That doesn't mean they couldn't in the future attempt that. But it does tell you how clueless we were to what was going on. a lot of the medical data that was stolen came not only out of the Office of Personnel Management, but out of insurance files from companies like Anthem, you know, which runs a lot of Blue Cross Blue Shield programs. You can imagine what kind of medical data they have. We think what the Chinese were doing was actually creating a giant database of Americans that they could use around the world, but it's not clear. What is clear is that the CIA had to suspend sending a good number of agents who were scheduled to go into China because they thought that they would be too easily spotted now that the Chinese had all these personnel records.
So that's one use of that kind of information, is to figure out who's coming across your border and who's and what they might be up to.
You know, what the Chinese were doing, it looks like, Warren, was building a very big integrated database of an elite group of Americans who held security clearances. And it's interesting to sort of consider, supposing the Chinese had stolen this data 10 years ago, before the invention of big data techniques that would enable them to filter and merge this data as effectively as they can today, it probably wouldn't have been terribly useful to them. They would have been overwhelmed by these 22 million files. Now they can figure out that, you know, Warren and David worked together on the same nuclear project back in, you know, 1985, and were in the same office at the same time. And so they can begin to establish a set of relationships that previously you really couldn't.
We're talking with David Sanger about the third in a series of books about cyber warfare and cyber aggression, starting with The Inheritance. Then it was Confront and Conceal. Now it's The Perfect Weapon, subtitled War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Once again, we're talking with David Sanger about his new book, The Perfect Weapon. And David, let me ask you this. You've talked about the Office of Personnel Management and how it got caught up in a cyber attack. What about the Department of Interior? It got involved in something, too. How did that happen?
Well, the Department of Interior was simply the place where the Office of Personnel Management was storing its data. It was doing that because Congress had passed a perfectly reasonable sounding law that said that before the government went out and bought a lot of cloud services at great expense for the United States, it should just put its data in unused computer storage anywhere they could find it in the U.S. government. Well, the Office of Personnel Management found it in the Interior Department. The problem is, nobody had put the kind of protections on the Interior Department's networks that you would put on, say, the Pentagon's networks or the CIA's. And suddenly we were storing incredibly sensitive personnel and information, and some of it top secret information, on a network that was really made for the national parks and, say, you know, tracking buffalo migration in Yellowstone.
Wow. So that was easily penetrated then, but how did it happen? It was an accident, wasn't it?
No, the Chinese had followed the groups that do the interviews for if you're checking out the security background of somebody who's applied for security clearance. They'll go around and interview people who know them. They'll put that data into a computer system, and the Chinese noticed that all that data was being stored at the Interior Department. So they started their attack at the Interior Department, figuring that no one knew them, and they were right.
So what about terrorism? You mentioned that earlier. And have we seen cyber terrorism or not?
We have not seen sophisticated uses of cyber weapons by terrorist groups. We have seen groups like ISIS use cyber in a pretty sophisticated way to go recruit people. And what we discovered, and this is covered in the book at some length, is that while the U.S. is very good at cyber offense, can go in after the Iranian centrifuges or the North Korean missiles, we haven't even turned yet to the big U.S. program aimed at North Korea, it's not very effective at countering the kind of ideological propaganda that runs on networks, the way ISIS used the web to recruit. And one reason for that is that that information can be stored in multiple copies around the world. So the U.S. would go in through Cyber Command, U.S. Cyber Command, which is the military's big cyber unit now, 6,000 soldiers strong, would go wipe out information on servers that ISIS was using, or bring those servers down or block the data, only to discover that the same information would show up a week or two later because it had also been stored in Germany or Canada or some other place, and it didn't take long for ISIS to get back up and running.
You mentioned the U.S. offensive against North Korea. Tell us about that.
Well, in January of 2014, Warren, President Obama realized that the North Koreans were moving ahead pretty quickly with their missile program, and he ordered a stepped-up effort to use cyber weapons and traditional electronic warfare to try to sabotage the North Korean missile launches. One of the interesting findings during our reporting for the book and for articles that appeared in the Times that Bill Broad and I did in appeared in March of 2017 was that while the North Koreans had a very high failure rate for one kind of medium-range missile called the Musudan, an 88% failure rate, we couldn't figure out, and we don't think the government was able to figure out, how much that 88% failure rate was a result of the cyber program and how much was just the result of bad engineering or bad luck on the part of the North Koreans, or the fact that the U.S. and other allies were sending in the parts to the missile program for many years. So it was hard to know how successful the cyber attacks were. What we do know is that Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, suspended all of those Musudan tests in October of 2016 and immediately started up with a different design, one that he clearly had ready, that was used to build intercontinental ballistic missiles as well. And those had a very high success rate in the test flights. So either the U.S. wasn't into that system or had decided it was being too obvious before in its activities against the Musudan.
Is there a reason to believe that Kim Jong-un was willing and eager to meet with President Trump, in part because he senses that he is on the defensive with regard to cyber warfare?
He may have. It's hard to know what the mix of calculations were. It's very much like Iran, where we mixed traditional economic sanctions with new cyber activity to try to make the point that the U.S. was not going to let them proceed with the nuclear program. But it's hard to know how much that played into Kim's calculus or how much he was worried that President Trump would just go in and bomb North Korea in the traditional way after the threats of last summer. So I don't know what the actual motivation was for Kim. What is clear is that cyber is being integrated into every military plan we have, including the ways that we use to try to go keep a missile from launching in hopes of increasing the chances that we'd be able to stop it either prior to launch or with missile defenses after launch.
You've talked about President Bush and President Obama, and that's how long all this has been going on. What about the Trump administration? Does it seem to be taking the same kind of interest, same kind of concern, and developing new strategies that the others had have some trouble with?
You know, if you'd asked me 6 months ago, is the Trump administration pushing on here, I would have said yes, that they had appointed some very sophisticated senior people, the Homeland Security advisor for the first year of the Trump administration, Tom Bossert, had experience in cyber from his time in the Bush administration, that the cyber coordinator at the White House is a very impressive former NSA official who had run the National Security Agency's Tailored Access Operations Unit. Most people have probably never heard of it, But that's the unit that breaks into foreign computer networks for the United States when the U.S. is doing covert actions, usually on the direct instructions of the president. So they put a well-known cyber warrior in charge of America's cyber defenses, which makes a lot of sense. If you spent your life breaking into systems, you're going to understand their vulnerabilities a whole lot better. But then John Bolton came in a few months ago, took over as national security advisor. Within days, he ousted Mr. Bossert. And then he not only pushed out the NSA executive, Rob Joyce, but he eliminated the role of White House cybersecurity coordinator. The White House just said, well, cyber is part of everything we do. And I view that as a pretty risky move, because the U.S. is nowhere close to developing the kind of doctrine we need for our cyber defenses.
What about the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, we haven't really sorted out where the responsibilities of one stops and the other begins. We know that the Department of Homeland Security has primary responsibility for the cyber defense of the United States. That makes some sense, because you don't want to over-militarize that. But there is some point at which an attack becomes so overwhelming that you'd want to have the Defense Department make sure that it was the central player. And nobody's quite figured out where that line is.
The last time you and I talked about this, we were doing a podcast about the use of what are called low-level or tactical nuclear weapons. And you reported, it's part of your new book, that in fact the United States in the new nuclear posture review has said that if in fact it suffers a all-out cyber attack, it will respond with nuclear weapons. Is that a effective kind of strategy?
I don't think so. I don't think it's a credible threat, particularly if that all-out cyber attack or non-nuclear attack came from a nuclear-equipped nation like Russia or China. I don't think the United States would make a first use of a nuclear weapon in response to a cyber attack. But it does reveal how desperate we are to develop some strategy that even the threat would be made.
If the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security aren't doing as much as we'd like them to, what about private companies? After all, cyber technology is everywhere.
It's a better first line of defense. You want your banks defending your bank accounts. You want the utilities defending the network so that you don't lose the power. And that will probably help against 85 or 90% of the threats, including the criminal threats. But I'm not sure it's going to help against states. If a state really is going to come after you, they've probably got the sophistication to break into these networks. And that's where the integration of U.S. defenses and U.S. defense strategy fit in. And that's what's missing right now. We're sort of where we were in the early days of the Cold War, when people were still trying to figure out how you were going to defend against nuclear missiles. And, you know, it took a long time for the technologists, the strategists, and others to figure that out, and then also to come up with some rules under which we would never use nuclear weapons in hopes of creating some norms of behavior. That largely succeeded. So far, it has not in the cyber realm.
Members of both parties on the Senate Intelligence Committee have said they believe intelligence reports that the Russians really did try to disrupt the election in 2016, and that they are likely to do it again. President Trump says he doesn't believe it. How important is that?
It's very important, because if President Trump doesn't believe it, it means that others in the U.S. government will not begin to go and take significant action. There has been some action against the Russians. There's a scene in the book where President Trump meets President Putin for the first time in Hamburg last summer, and they discussed the election. And then the president called me from Air Force One right after the meeting to make the argument to me that President Putin had said to him, it couldn't have been the Russians who did the attack, because if it was, we never would have seen them. They're just that good. And he seemed impressed by that argument. I said I wasn't very impressed by the argument, because this wasn't meant to be a hidden attack. At least, obviously, once you release emails and so forth, it's pretty obvious that there had been a cyber attack, and it was pretty obvious where it came from. But periodically, he will say, yes, I guess I understand what the intelligence agencies have said, but he doesn't actually believe it himself, because he's afraid that, I think, if he does agree that it was the Russians, then it would call into question the legitimacy of his own presidency. I think it's entirely possible you could have had a situation in which the president, soon after he took office, said, look, I was legitimately elected, but we can never again allow a foreign nation to interfere in our elections. And he could have created a presidential commission like the 9/11 commission to go examine what lessons we should have learned from the 2016 election. He didn't do that, and I think that's left us in a more vulnerable situation.
David Sanger, once again, is in Europe as we speak. He will be looking into this issue there. The Europeans are very concerned about it. Again, he's national security correspondent for the New York Times, specializing in cyber technology, and his latest book is The Perfect Weapon. Many, many thanks.
Thank you, Warren.
Andrea Brody produced this podcast. Joel Stein is our engineer. I'm Warren Alney. To the Point is available wherever you get your podcast. If you use Apple Podcasts, don't forget, give us a recommendation and join us again.